Hey everyone, welcome to the Behind the Scenes podcast. I'm Jeremy.
And I'm Audrey.
And on this podcast, we share the messy, honest, unfiltered, and not so curated parts of our life.
Think of this podcast as a bunch of bloopers with some truth bombs sprinkled throughout.
That's right. We're going to be taking you behind the scenes of our daily routines, our social media feeds, and what you may or may not have seen on TV.
We're going to be talking relationships, family, faith, business, basically whatever we are learning about, fighting about, or laughing about lately.
We're going to be sharing our daily life, our struggles, successes, and our roses and thorns from each week.
And we don't want this podcast to just be about us, so we're also going to go behind the scenes with some of the people who inspire us the most.
We hope this podcast feels like you're joining us for a campfire.
Come hang out.
Hey, you guys. So good to be here. Another episode of Behind the Scenes Podcast. Babe, how you doing?
Doing okay. We are home, actually, now. Done with book tour, and I got really sick. Got a book tour hangover. Not from alcohol, but just from a lot of work the past month. So well, I'm just not
plane rides and
all the travel.
Your immune system has just been.
It was like Saturday night. We woke up Easter morning, and it just hit me. And I probably sound like it right now. In the recording of this episode, I sound hopefully a little bit better because we pre-recorded this episode a few weeks back. But
yep. So this is a really special near and dear to our heart podcast, or shall I say conversation. We're talking today with John Mark Comer, and few people have had more of a shaping and an influence in our, I would say in our
life,
in our spiritual development, if you will, from afar than John Mark Comer. Whether it's his podcast, Bridgetown podcast, going to his church. It was just actually the church we met at. His books. All three have just been foundational and very shaping for our, just as we trudge onward in the pursuit of being disciples to Jesus. He's had immense influence. But yes, what were you going to say, babe, about the church?
Yes, I was just going to say, I think we mentioned this in the podcast, but Jeremy and I actually met at his church, Bridgetown. It was the first ever service of their downtown campus that they did a church plant in downtown Portland. So that's where Jared and I actually met.
Yeah.
So it's just like been a special part of our story. And John Mark, we're talking to him today in this podcast episode about marriage relationships and God's design for all of it. But also, you guys should check out his books because he is a wealth of wisdom when it comes to many other things. We were pinholing him a little bit into marriage in this episode.
Studied, well-versed. He's got a book about relationships as well called Loveology. But probably my favorite book of his is God Has a Name, and it's his most recent book, and I know he's writing another right now, but if you haven't read or checked out God Has a Name by John Mark Comer, highly, highly, highly recommend that book. Definitely go get it.
And also his book Garden City influenced a lot of how Jeremy and I do Sabbath, and a lot of you guys ask us about that. So if you want to find out more about that, check that book out because it's also a great one on the topic. So anyways.
All that being said, it's an honor to talk to John Mark Comer today, and I think you guys will find the same admiration we have for him after today's podcast. Or today's conversation with him. And so he endorsed the book as well, which
also is an honor.
So without further ado, here is our conversation with John Mark Comer. All right, John Mark Comer, welcome to the show.
Hey guys, great to be with you.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's first of all, a pleasure just to have you on the podcast. I want to start off just by saying to all the listeners and to you, you've had a really awesome impact on our education, I feel, and just kind of our understanding of the scriptures and your teachings and whatnot. And so,
Specifically how, you know, we view love and how we approach dating and just also like a lot of,
you know, the concepts and things that we share in our book have come from things that we've learned from you throughout the years. And then, of course, Jeremy and I met at the opening service of Bridgetown. So
I know,
it's kind of a cool, full circle.
That's so incredible. God, I was reading your book and I'm like, wait a minute. I think that, I don't know if it was the first day or introduction or whatever.
Yep.
I'm like, I think that's our church they're writing about, I think.
Yeah. It was the opening service,
first service of Bridgetown downtown. When it was
Wow, what a small world. That would have been, what, 9 years ago, something like that?
Yeah. Yep. Wow. Almost exactly. Yeah.
Well
so,
done.
Anyways,
you guys.
It's an honor and we're really excited to have you on the show. So
For
those of you who don't know, people who don't know who you are, can you just give a quick, like, you know,
who
Sparks
you are,
no elevator
where you live
pitch?
And what you do?
Yeah, you got it. I am one of the pastors and the primary teacher at a church called Bridgetown Church, right in the urban core of Portland, Oregon, up in the Pacific Northwest, not far from you guys at all. Mm-hmm. And I teach the way of Jesus. My kind of great passion for life is spiritual formation, which is just semi-academic language for the process by which we are formed into the image of Jesus and grow and mature into our real, true, best self. Seeing spiritual formation come into churches in post-Christian context. That's kind of what I do. Mm. So I teach people, I do my best to help people grow and mature and help teach them how to follow Jesus in this kind of secular, crazy, hostile to Jesus and his way, cultural moment and context that we find, many of us find ourselves in. That's what I do. I write books, I talk.
You've got a podcast.
Drink coffee. You know, I don't get to drink coffee, but I drink a lot of coffee, read a lot of books.
Yes.
Awesome.
So good.
Love that. And you do a great job at it. So
we've been some
benefactors from that for sure. So why don't we, or why don't you just kind of tell us the spark notes of your love story? Your wife is not on with us right now, but Tammy. How did you guys meet? Just catch us up to where you're at now.
Yeah, you know, it's crazy. So I think your book comes out April 2nd, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And April 4th will be 20 years of us being together.
Nice.
Which is pretty cool. And this summer will be 18 years of marriage. So we met, I played in a band with her older brother, and we would rehearse. So we were really young when we met. When we met, she would have been, I think, 18 and I was 19, something like that. And just children, you know? And I was roommates with her brother, but her parents have this big old house that had this huge basement with a recording studio in it. So our band used to rehearse in his parents' house, where she was a junior in high school. So she was still living at home.
We
would play. And then there was this beautiful little sister that would just come and offer us tea or coffee and I thought she was just really, you know, gracious. And apparently she was intentionally flirting with me the whole time.
Nice.
But it worked. I fell for it. And then we began getting to know each other over a number of months and started dated for a few years as we were still really young, and then got married super young. Her parents wanted me to be 21 before we got married. So we got married the first Saturday after my 21st birthday.
Love that.
That tells you all sorts of things about my personality. And it's really interesting. It's not, you know, it's easy to make that sound really idyllic, but actually, I mean, your prefrontal cortex isn't even developed all the way till you're 22 to 24 years old. And so it literally was a few years into our marriage before we woke up one day and realized,
whoa.
Oh crap, what did we just do? And who are we? And we're two very different people from two very different families of origins and very different, you know, background. And it was actually a pretty kind of idyllic dating experience and pretty rough early marriage experience that has been a beautiful journey, not back toward idyllic, but rather beautiful journey toward a more Christ-like love.
Yeah, wow, love that. What would you say was kind of like the number one? Because, you know, you get married, right? And then we're one, but then we have to figure out what that actually means. What was kind of like, if anything, the one thing that helped you guys kind of iron out some of that early marriage stuff? You know, just like in that process of becoming one?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like pain is almost always the entry point to growth as in general, you know?
Yeah.
Whether it's you know, character growth or spiritual growth, meaning kind of your relationship with the spirit, or interpersonal relational growth. I just feel like pain is always where the growth edge is, you know?
Yeah, it's good.
And so our pain just forced us to intimacy, you know, because when you have a kind of happily shallow relationship where everything's kind of just going great and you're having fun together and what do you want to do tonight? Let's go do this, fun. You're not really forced to deal with the pain of your own woundedness and the way that your woundedness intermingles with another person's woundedness. And, you know, marriage in particular for my personality, and I think much of both the secular and Christian cultural moment right now is so racked by a toxic idealism that it's just a setup for disillusionment at best, if not full-on divorce or, you know, worse. And so I think it forced us to some honesty and some intimacy early on, you know, and it's just so helpful to always think about the pain points in a relationship as the invitations both for deeper intimacy and for deeper maturity in your own character. So that's I mean, I would mostly, that's a long way of saying fighting.
No, that's really good.
Heated fellowship, really good, as Emerson calls it.
So one of the things, you know, the subtitle of our book is Pursue Creatively, Date Intentionally, and Love Faithfully. And that's really like what we are trying to encourage and empower and hopefully give people some tips and ways that they can do that wherever they're at in their love story, whether they're just beginning or whether they're 15 years in. And so just curious to hear from you, like, you know, when we look to Jesus, Jesus was all about telling stories and asking questions. So what can we, like, what encouragement can you give to our generation who's maybe in the dating season or engaged or early years of marriage? What kinds of stories have inspired you or would be inspiring to our generation to be more intentional, creative, and faithful in our love stories? And then what kind of questions do you think would be good for our generation to be asking in that season?
Oh, man. Gosh, that's some great questions. I mean, I think, not to sound overly basic, but you kind of have to start with the question, what is love?
Which
might sound a little bit weird, because I think love is one of those words where we all think we know what it means, but many of us don't. And if you get love wrong, then you're going to get a vision of what marriage is wrong.
That's scary.
And then you're going to be failing at arriving at an unachievable destination and missing out on what marriage actually is and what God is actually doing, you know? So I think, you know, often when people ask the question that you just asked, which is a great question, like, what are the stories? What people want to hear is kind of like the Hollywood Notebook-esque kind of inspiration stories. And then the Christian version of them. So, like, honestly, I'll let you know in a little secret. My wife and I can barely listen to any Christian teaching on marriage because we find it far more toxic than helpful 9 times out of 10. Because what we experience, much of the Christian kind of literature and teaching and cultural thing, is often just a Christianized kind of Christian culture version of the secular personal fulfillment and happiness through this other human being, romanticism. Which is, we think, actually deeply even hostile to Jesus' definition of love. And is definitely damaging to our relationship, because what we end up doing is trying to do this new technique or date night thing or whatever, creative, not bad things, but often the underlying stated or unstated goal is to, like, breathe, you know, the endorphin-based romanticism of dating back into a marriage. And, you know, we just always ask, man, what if that's not the goal? What if that's actually immaturity, not maturity? Because obviously all the science, if you're just chatting to a secular evolutionary psychologist, the science is that, you know, when you meet somebody, you have this massive, like, neurochemical reaction in your body that releases this flood of, you know, serotonin and dopamine and endorphins, of basically this feeling of happiness that you get from being around this person that, you know, a secular evolutionary psychologist would say is designed to get you to commit your life to that person in marriage and through sexuality before you actually know what it is that you're signing up for. Because if you knew what you were signing up for, you most likely wouldn't do it. And it's designed to push you into marriage, sex, and commitment. The most base evolutionary psychologists would say it's just designed to get your, you know, sperm in the gene pool. A more sophisticated one who had more respect for the reality of God would say it's probably God graciously helping you get married, because if you actually knew how hard it was going to be, you probably wouldn't do it. And, you know, that would, if you read M. Scott Peck. So if you're a reader, have you guys read The Road Less Traveled by M. Scott Peck?
I don't know. No.
Oh man, it's one of my top 10 favorite books of all time. Dallas Willard once said that if he was stranded on a desert island and could only take one book with him, it would be this. And it's not even a Christian book. And his section on love and romance and marriage is unlike anything that you'll pretty much read in the marriage literature, and is the most important thing I've ever read.
Oh my goodness. Fantastic. Okay, I can't believe we
have
that.
Give us the title one more time.
It's called The Road. It's called The Road Less Traveled by M. Scott Peck, who a generation ago was kind of the preeminent popular level psychologist. He's a PhD who actually later in life became a follower of Jesus. So when he wrote that book, he was kind of friendly to the idea of Jesus, but was more of a kind of agnostic universalist kind of thing, was a secular guy. And then he later became a follower of Jesus, and late in life did some really fascinating writing around kind of Jesus and psychology. But that book, which sold millions of copies, is a secular book, but it's very friendly to a religion in general and Jesus in particular.
Very interesting. Well, it sounds really like good. A grandeur version of my favorite book, A Severe Mercy by Sheldon Vanocken.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yes.
It's amazing.
So you've read it?
Yeah, with Lewis and Vanocken.
Yeah, with Lewis Vanocken. Yeah, yeah. So the similar concept in the sense that he was writing about love and beauty as, you know, just a secular, you know, guy. But it was through that pursuit he ultimately found Jesus.
God.
Yeah, found God.
Yeah. The other amazing book on this view of marriage is The Meaning of Marriage by Tim Keller.
Yeah,
we love that.
Isn't so much a page turner, but it is is the best book I've ever read on marriage. Whenever I officiate a wedding, I don't do very many as a pastor, but when I do, I have two requirements. One is you have to write your own vows, and two is you have to read The Meaning of Marriage by Tim Keller.
Love that.
So good.
To everyone listening,
wield a little pastoral authority while you have it, you know?
Yes.
Yeah.
Or I will not marry. I will not marry you.
Yeah. So you mentioned something that I think is really interesting, and it's something we believe in, but I kind of want to ask you to unpack it just a little bit. So if we knew what we were getting ourselves into, right, many folks might not get into it, going back to the whole endorphin rush and kind of like that physical convincing of ourselves,
which is temporary. And that's what I got.
Which is temporary.
Yeah. It lasts on average 2 years. And then no matter who your spouse is or how beautiful or handsome or cool or whatever, it's done.
Well, that kind of begs the question.
Yeah.
Well, there is a meaning to marriage and it's not marriage itself.
Mm-hmm.
So like what is, and if it's hard, well, what are we achieving? Because running a marathon is very difficult. But when you're training, you know what you're going towards. So what is the meaning of marriage? And we don't need to get super into it, but just kind of high level, 30,000 foot view. What is marriage doing to us and why is it hard?
Yeah, totally. Well, I mean, again, what is the meaning of marriage? You have to step back to worldview. So if you're a true secular thinker, there's no meaning to anything. Life is an accident. You're an animal, time and chance on your side. There's no marriage is a social construct developed by the patriarchy in the Byzantine era to make more money for your clan. You know, that's the most cynical secular reading. And human beings can't live without meaning. Mm. So, you know, even neurobiologically, neuroscientists are now saying that the human mind is hardwired to search for meaning. So it's literally built to take random data points and attempt to assemble them together into some kind of a coherent story mm-hmm. or narrative to make sense of reality. So human beings can't live without meaning. So the ironic thing is when we set aside the idea of God and create, you know, creator, creation, which comes with design, intent, and then accountability, and then morality and all of that, and life becomes meaningless. Well, you can't live a meaningless life if you actually follow that logic through. It's impossible to even, much less organize a society. You can't even live as an individual without some kind of meaning to your life other than survival side of math. So people then have to basically develop meanings that are self-imputed into life. So, you know what I mean? They have to say, well, there's no meaning to life, but I'm going to make my meaning justice for this people group or crushing it as a lawyer or whatever it is. And so, you know, marriage is still around for lots of secular people that, you know, don't think there's a creator and a God and creation and design and intent and all of that, and don't, you know, buy the worldview that marriage was created by God. And so for most people in that secular worldview, the meaning of life in general becomes basically to be happy, you know, and this is kind of the post-Freudian kind of, well, if there's no meaning in life, we all like to feel good. And so it becomes basically about maximize pleasure and minimize pain, i.e. be as happy as you can. And so when that theory of life, which is the basic secular Western life philosophy, maximize pleasure, minimize pain. And when that is applied to marriage, it's the same thing. Maximize pleasure, minimize pain. Pleasure looks like happiness.
It's true. Yeah.
Pain looks like any kind of unhappiness, relational conflict, disease, you know, whatever it is, you know? And, you know, even if you're a follower of Jesus and hearing that worldview, you say, that's not what I believe at all. The reality is all of us have been spiritually formed by the Western world if you grew up in it. It's impossible to live in a city like Portland or a country like America.
America.
And not have been spiritually formed by that.
Yeah.
You know, there's a Catholic thinker, Michael Novak, who has this great, like, threefold, like, three levels of belief. And he has, you know, you have your public belief, which is what you say that you believe, but it's not actually what you believe. So this would be Harvey Weinstein standing up at the, Golden Globes or whatever before that, before everything broke. And he's wearing the pin. The like, you know, pro women in Hollywood, whatever is before me too. He's wearing the pin. You know what I mean? Like, so that's a public belief to the world. Mm. He's wearing the right pin. He's saying the right spiel, but he doesn't actually believe any of that.
Yeah.
Then you have your private belief, which isn't actually what you believe. It's what you think you believe. And then Then you have your core belief, which is what you actually believe. And you may or may not have that register at a conscious level. So apply this to marriage. A lot of us would say, well, you know, I don't believe that the point of marriage is just to be happy. I think it's, and then they would fill in the blank with some more Christian kind of vision of marriage. But still, that might, their core belief, like underneath the right answer, might actually believe, I'm marrying this person because they make me feel happy. They make me want to have sex. And that's basically what I want out of marriage, is somebody to fulfill me emotionally and sexually. And that is for many of, that was definitely my core belief. You had asked me on my wedding day, 21 years old, do you think the point of marriage is for your wife T to just make you feel happy all the time and sexually satisfied? And I would say, no, of course I don't think that's the reason for marriage. But that actually was my core belief going into it. And I'd just been so shaped by the Western motif, you know? I say that just by way of introduction. Obviously, as a follower of Jesus, I have a very different perspective on life as a whole. I believe there's a creator. I believe I'm in creation. I believe that the human body, human sexuality, gender, marriage itself, I don't think is just a social construct. Of course, it's shaped by each culture. But I think the fact that it is through every single culture and every single era of history is just an anthropological signpost to the biblical idea that it was created by God and not by people. I think neurobiologically we're wired not just for community, but for soul ties, deep, intimate soul level connections.
Yes.
And so obviously in the biblical theology of marriage, I have a little, very simple five kind of point framework of the five reasons for marriage from biblical theology. So if you just take Genesis and the story of Adam and Eve in the garden, you get four basic reasons for marriage pre-sin. One is, put simply, just friendship. Like, there's that great line, it's not good for man to be alone. And, you know, just the human ache, the loneliness in particular in Western culture now, as we're more and more isolated and transient and, you know, trust issues and attachment breakdown. So marriage is just like, not the only, but it is a beautiful place for just friendship, companionship, relationship, being with another person. You know, two is obviously some, you know, I call it gardening. What I mean by that is just a Garden of Eden. Like in the Garden of Eden story, Adam and Eve are put there to take this shalom of the Garden of Eden and then to spread it out to the four corners of the earth. This is a theology that's later developed by Jesus into this vision of the kingdom of God. And so I think there's a partnership would be the second reason, where two people come together to do, to spread God's Eden, his shalom, his rule and his reign out to more of the world and more of humanity in ways that they could not accomplish if they were all alone.
Love that.
Three is just sexuality. You know what I mean? God created in the story sexual beings. Like human beings are sexual beings. We have a powerful sexual energy inside of us. And God created marriage as the relational container and the only one that is strong enough in a biblical theology of both marriage and sex to kind of hold the sexual power in all of us and energy in all of us. So marriage is this place to enjoy and to express your sexuality. And then finally, family. This is a very long time before the pill. And so marriage and sexuality are all tied to, you know, increase in number to family.
Yeah.
So in a biblical theology, marriage is basically about you have somebody to do life with, you're doing something that matters in the world together, you're sleeping together and enjoying that, and you're making babies and raising kids. Like that's a biblical theology of marriage. Now that's all pre-sin. Once sin comes in, it basically just the first place that wreaks havoc in the Genesis story is in marriage. The first place.
Yeah.
In relationships between men and women in general, and husbands and wives in particular, that becomes like the locus point of the pain, that and for a man in particular, but for both, tension with the earth, with, you know, kind of the field and what we now call work. And in light of that, in light of what theologians call the fall, or, you know, Christians mostly just call sin, you have, I think, a fifth reason that's kind of added, and that would be spiritual formation. You know, marriage is where in the safe place of loving intimacy, the best of you comes out and the worst of you comes out. And that's the tricky thing about marriage. Like, you know, in spiritual formation, one of the first things you realize is that the last person to experience your growth and maturity is your spouse or the person that you're closest to. So just think about it. Like pretty much anybody, I've never chatted to anybody who said differently, the people that we treat the worst are the people that we love the most.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So if you were to follow me around with a hidden GoPro looking
totally.
My life, the worst moments, if you just followed me around for a week, all of the worst moments that you would capture would be interactions with my wife and my children, which
are so interesting.
Yes. It's bizarre. And it's and it's actually a good thing. It's because I feel safe with them.
Yeah.
So if I were to go hang out at your guys' house, you wouldn't really capture those moments unless if something really crazy happened.
Yeah. Yeah. Really crazy.
Don't take this the wrong way. It's because I wouldn't feel safe with you. And that's not because you're bad people or unsafe.
No.
It's because we don't have that level of intimacy and relationship.
Right.
For sure.
But when you guys are with each other, or when you're with your child, or when you're with your parents, all of a sudden, like, you feel safe and you just psychologically, you just immediately let your guard down. And I want to say that the worst in me comes out because I'm tired or had a hard day at work. And actually, the real me is what comes out. And this is the tragedy. This is the ache. This is the pain of marriage. But the beauty is if it comes out and then you experience a combination of, and this is, I don't want to idealize this because no partner can do this perfectly or even well, but you experience a combination of somebody calling you on your crap and loving you and forgiving you in spite of your crap. That is a powerful transformational tool in your growth. If you, you know, so practically, I come home, I'm tired, I'm grouchy, somebody sent me a nasty email, whatever the thing is. I am then rude and caustic and entitled with my wife around whatever the issue is. She then says, hey, you're being rude to me. And then ideally, it never works quite this well, but I then then I immediately apologize because I'm a pastor. It doesn't normally work that way. I apologize and then I experience love and forgiveness and we move on. That, which happens to any healthy marriage 10 times a day, or at least 10 times a week or whatever, that is a powerful transformational tool in our formation into Christ-likeness.
Hey guys, wanted to take a quick minute to take a break from the awesome conversation with John Mark Comer to tell you guys about our new book, A Love Letter Life. If you have still not grabbed your copy of A Love Letter Life yet, I believe it's still $12.20 on Amazon. And it has been just so encouraging to read the reviews, comments, and messages that we've received of how this book is impacting lives and love stories. So we wanted to take a second to read you a couple of the reviews that we have received that have just been such an encouragement to us and hopefully to you. So the first is from Shelby. She says, "Wow, wow, wow. When I bought this book, I was thinking I was going to be reading a cute love story. How shocked was I when I found myself crying and journaling throughout the entire book? I honestly couldn't put it down. I have been married almost 2 years, and I can tell you there are some amazing takeaways from this book. It is honestly applicable to any stage of life that you are in. I plan on making my daughter read this when she gets older and we start talking about what dating and marriage looks like that is centered around Christ. Our entire community group at church bought this book after I raved about it, and they also couldn't put it down. It's no wonder it's a New York Times bestseller. I could go on and on about this, but ultimately, I truly believe many lives are going to be touched by this book. Thank you so much, Shelby, for sharing that review. It's so encouraging to us and hopefully to our listeners and readers."
Yeah, then here's one from Elise. Or I'm sorry, I think it's Elsie. "As someone who has read literally hundreds of books on the topic of love, marriage, and relationships, I have a very high standard when I begin a new book. This book is written by a couple who has only been married a few years or so. So I expected it to be light and a fun read, but full of meat? No, probably not. I could not have been more wrong. This couple blew me away as I read their honest struggles, trials, joy, and life lessons. I learned as they journeyed towards marriage. I quickly told people that this book would be required reading for all six of my kids. When they came and told me they wanted to start dating, I was encouraged, enlightened, and even guided by the Holy Spirit to read a specific section on a day I was struggling to communicate with my husband, and then read exactly what I needed to say in this book. So, long story short, you need this book. Your kids will need this book. The focus on God just seeps from the pages as Jeremy and Audrey talk about their intentional living and truly encouraged me to become more intentional in my own marriage. 15 years and I'm still learning." Wow. Amazing. You guys, these reviews are so, so, so encouraging. I know they help a lot of people when looking for new books. So thank you. Thank you. If you guys have not grabbed the book, as Audrey said, you can still do so on Amazon. Without further ado, back to our conversation with John Mark Comer.
So good. So many good, that was really good. Amazingly articulated points. And just thank you for sharing and elaborating on that.
I think it's going to be very valuable for our listeners.
That safety comes from commitment. It sounds, I mean, right?
Yes.
Because like when you're with.
You know, you're in this place of, you know, and ironically, you know, and tragically, marriage means less and less. And so for many people, they're technically in a marriage, but they're still racked by anxiety because they think their spouse will leave them if they gain too much weight or can't deal with their thing, or
they got to continually earn it.
Yeah. So it's just like striving in the Tinder-esque world, or what, it's the striving to earn, you know. But in a healthy marriage where it literally, which is why the, you know, the widespread divorce is a tragedy for our whole society. But in a healthy marriage, when there is literally a fidelity of until death do us part, richer, this is why the vows, the historic vows, richer or poor, sickness or in health, no matter what. You know, I might be mad at you. I might yell at you. I might, you know, constantly call, but I will stay. I will stay here with you and fight for you. That's a powerful tool.
It's so
good. You know, what we often, so often, the mistakes we make in marriage is one, we have the wrong metrics for success. So, I mean, to set on one side the secular vision, which is many of our vision of what's the point of marriage? To be happy. Mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, what's the point of marriage? Well, to have a friend, to have a partner, to have a lover, to have a parent, and to become more like Jesus. So often, you know what I mean? You can have a marriage that is failing by the secular metrics, meaning it doesn't match the idealized kind of Hollywood, which is so ironic because marriages in Hollywood are generally a disaster.
Yeah, it doesn't match
the Hollywood-esque image of happiness. But actually, the marriage can be a total raging success by all the metrics of a biblical theology of marriage. You can actually be friends and partners and lovers and parents and becoming more like Jesus and still feel like your marriage is a failure because you don't emotionally have the same romantic euphoria that you have when you were younger, other people have. So the first mistake is I just think we have the wrong metrics for success. And then the second mistake I think we make is that we rate the wrong person. So rather, this is, and this is just me, like 100, I do this weekly.
Rate?
Rather than...
We rate the wrong person?
Yeah, we rate the wrong person. Meaning like, so when we all do this inner, maybe this is just me. I play this inner like game in my mind. Is my marriage a healthy marriage or not?
Yeah.
So I guess what I'm trying to say is first I get in trouble when I have the wrong metrics, but, and I define healthy as I feel happy or whatever.
Yeah, you know, so
rather
good.
Than friendship, partnership, sex, parenting, and formation. Yes. The second mistake I make is I rate the wrong person. So even if I have the right metrics, I'll think, well, is Tammy being a good friend to me? Not am I being a good friend to her?
Mm-hmm.
Is Tammy being a good partner to me? Not am I being a good partner with her? Is Tammy being a good lover to me? Not am I being a good lover to her? You know, so on. Is she making me more like Christ? Not am I helping her to reach her full redemptive potential? Mm-hmm. And that's the other, because the reality, one of the first things that you learn in marriage, how long have you guys been married?
Wow,
coming up on 5 years.
Five. You didn't even start to learn this till 7 years in. I think you guys are already kind of experts. So hopefully this is
no, 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 no. We are not experts.
Don't say that. You're farther down the path than we were.
Yeah.
No.
But man, I just had to learn. It was such a hard lesson for me, especially, but for both of us. But that I am incapable of changing my wife, and actually, that's not my job.
Yes.
You know, and the saying goes, the only person you can change is yourself. I can't even change myself. And that's where, as a follower of Jesus, you know, my theology of spiritual formation is, man, the need for grace, the need for community, the need for teaching and truth. I can't even change myself.
That's hard enough.
But I definitely have, more capacity over myself than over my spouse. And any energies I put toward change should be primarily directed at me growing into a better friend, partner, lover, dad, and Christ-like person, not toward her.
Yeah, so good. Man, so good. I think we might have quoted you in later on in the book. It's something like, it's not our job to change our spouse's hearts, it's God's or something. It was something along those lines, but...
Sounds like something we said at some point.
Sounds like something lots of wise Christians
have said.
I won't take any credit for that quote.
It was... Yeah, it was something along those lines, but love that.
And ironically, you know, and this could just be the inner phenomenology of my marriage, but my wife, for at least, really does not respond well to my attempts to change her to meet my definition of who I want her to be, you know?
She's not the only one.
And I'm guessing that's not just a T thing. I'm guessing not even just a female thing. I'm guessing that's just a human thing.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
And definitely. Ironically, what I've found is the more pressure I put on her, and often it's not even, sometimes it's pressure for her to just grow as a person into just a healthy, mature adult. Sometimes it's pressure for her to grow into my preference, you know? And that's where it gets really dangerous. So we went away 7 years into our marriage. We were just, our marriage was just in pretty bad shape. There's no infidelity or anything like that.
Yeah.
It was technically moral, but man, it was not a place of love and of delight. And it was definitely not a happy marriage. And so we went away for a couple of days of intensive counseling with this older couple. And again, we were super young and we didn't grow up in a therapeutic culture or a culture that had a high value for psychology or spiritual formation or kind of the inner world. And so we came into a lot of this stuff later and we did a couple of days of just personality testing. And it was our first time, I think, doing like Myers-Briggs and the DISC test and all this stuff. And again, you guys are probably way past this already. And I think there's way more tools now than there was for us when we got married. But it was an eye-opening moment for us to just realize, like, one of the lines we heard a lot, at least in the church we grew up in and that Christian subculture we came up in, was never try to change your spouse. And that's, I kind of just said that and it sounds kind of great until you're in a marriage and you're like, but they do this thing and it's horrible and it drives me nuts. And I hate it. And I wish they would do this other thing that they don't do. And I really want them to, you know?
Yeah.
And I think the general idea is fine, but non-nuanced, like love them as they are. Don't change. Don't try to change them. And then there's the secular version that basically says you should love and accept me exactly as I am with no changes.
Yeah.
Which right, is, I mean, that's like anti-Christian.
That's, for sure.
So that's you let totally. Me do whatever the heck I want to do. And I still want you to think I'm amazing. That's right. Just, that's not only anti-Christian, it's just absurd. And yet you hear that constantly in the secular mantra, which is why divorce
increasingly.
Is all over the place. Yeah. Well, I'd never even make it to marriage because of that mindset.
Yeah.
It's like we should be catalysts for change in each other's lives. Like I want to be someone that helps Jeremy change and grow and mature. I want Jeremy to be that for me. But it's just the how that we do that. That's the delicate.
How do we do that?
Yeah. Not in a manipulative way. Not in a way that's, you know what I mean? How do we do that in a way that God is God honoring to our spouse and to God, you know?
Yes. And how do we, and what are the things that we do and do not try to change? And that,
right.
When we went away 7 years in, did all these tests, the eye-opening thing for us, and again, this is such a like marriage 101 insight. But for us, you know, 7 years into marriage, it's like, oh my gosh, was just the reality that, and again, this is a Christian framework, but there are some aspects of each other, both of myself and my wife, that are sinful. Like this is, you know what I mean? In the language of the church tradition, and that are just lame and immature and unhealthy and unchristlike. And to want to change those things. And actually part of my responsibility as a husband is to help my spouse overcome those aspects of her personhood and vice versa for me.
Yeah.
Then there are other aspects of a spouse, and this is true of any spouse, I'll just use T as an example, that are maybe not my preference, but are just personality and how God made them to be and are not moral issues or spiritual issues, their preference and personality issues. And often they are, you know what I mean? The backside of the very things that initially drew our attraction, you know, so a very practical example in my marriage would be, you know, Tammy and I come from a kind of very Anglo-European white, you know, kind of family of origin. She's a Mexican immigrant, family of origin, warm culture. So one of the things that drove me, like just totally drew me to her, was she's so relaxed and calm and warm and present to the moment, none of which are naturally true of me. And I just, I was a moth to the flame.
Yeah.
I fell in love.
Yeah.
The downside of that is she's basically late for everything.
Yeah, which you can't stand.
She constantly drops the ball on like responsibility and it drives me up the wall, you know?
Yeah.
And when you're in love and you're like, oh, she's so calm and relaxed and present. And then a couple years into a marriage, you're like, she's always late. And you know what I mean? And, but the reality is that that's not a moral issue, you know, you know, she's regularly 10 minutes late for things. That's not like a moral spiritual issue.
Yeah.
That's me importing my predominantly white, predominantly Western, you know, middle class kind of value system. You make an appointment, you're there 10 minutes early, you know what I mean? Importing that onto her and saying, I wish that she was the kind of person who was always 10 minutes early for everything. She's not. And then me trying to manipulate her into the kind of spouse that I want, forgetting that it's the very backside to the strength that I love about her, that she's so relaxed,
so
present,
good.
Prioritizes people over tasks and is more interested in being present and love.
That's a very good
than
point.
In being somewhere 10 minutes early, you know?
Yeah, and that's really
so
good.
So that was so helpful for us just to distinguish. Like, man, there is certain the preference personality stuff I just need to basically deal with and honor and keep celebrating the side. Because, you know, what's the line? Weakness is strength in excess, you know, or what's the Enneagram line? The best part of you is also the worst part of you. So just constantly retraining my mind to celebrate who she is in personality. And then tuck back, make a much, much shorter list of like, here are some areas where she is not like Jesus and vice versa here for her. Here are some areas that I'm not like Jesus that we really want to help each other grow and mature into.
Love it. That's super good. And for us, yeah, we haven't done the Myers-Briggs necessarily, but the Enneagram has been, of course, the Christian community is going bonkers over it right now. But, yes. But for good
reason, yeah.
Everyone's obsessed, but for good reason, it has been absolutely like phenomenal in a dramatic way on how Audrey and I are like, oh, like I'm understanding a lot more about you.
Yes.
About me. So that's good to hear. Well, John Mark, I know we're kind of wrapping up on our time here, but there is one more question we had if we're able to go through it. Just being a pastor, being kind of involved in love stories and marriages and whatnot, what do you see given the current state of America, Western culture? What do you see as the biggest threat to love stories? Like if you were to like hold up a warning sign and say, hey, watch out for this. This is a roadblock. People say there's no such thing as shortcuts in life, and I don't believe that. I think there are a lot of shortcuts, and they come from
people that have... There's definitely detours in life.
There's definitely detours in life. And so if you could say to us and our audience, our listeners, like, hey, like this is what I see as a huge threat to current modern-day love stories, what would that be?
Yeah, I mean, I think the two things that immediately come to mind is, one, what we've mostly been chatting about, the idealized Hollywood / Instagrammy vision of love and marriage as an endorphin rush that lasts for 2 years. And then how do we prolong that? I think that is the root cause behind, you know, you combine Hollywood with Instagram, with a secular culture that has no meaning. So happiness becomes the default meaning, and you have a lethal combination. Jonathan Haidt, if you've not read his little book, The Happiness Hypothesis, Jonathan Haidt, great thinker.
That's on my list.
Yeah, good, fantastic. There are, you could probably find the images online, just Google them, or you could probably put them in the show notes, has these two great graphs, and there's sociological data behind them. It's not just his opinion or theory, on what he calls the passionate marriage or relationship versus what he calls the companionate marriage. And he tracks two different like levels. One is the level of passion, and what he means by that is emotional euphoria and intensity around this other person. And the other is companionship, a deep sense of like intimacy, soul connection, friendship, shoulder to shoulder companionship. And first he has a graph that shows you over 6 months, and basically the passionate thing skyrockets up to the top of the chart within like a week or two or three, and is basically at the top for, in his, most of the literature I've read says 2 years, but in his it's 6 months. And then it basically plummets back down the other end.
Wild.
Meaning you meet somebody, you fall in love, you go crazy, like, and then there's like this crash, whether it's 6 months or 2 years in or whatever. And then it basically never recovers. It basically teeters along right along the bottom. And then he showed, and then the companionate marriage basically has this tiny little low, you barely see, it's very, almost near the bottom, almost see no growth curve. You can imagine like a graph in your mind. And then he goes, and then he gives you the 60-year version, not the 6 month version, but the 60-year version. And basically what you see is that other than that initial spark and passion, passion basically just kind of hovers up and down along the bottom for the whole 60 years. And the companionate thing basically starts at the bottom and just gets higher and higher and higher.
That's so fascinating.
I love that.
And it's just another way of viewing what marriage is and what is a successful marriage. So anyway.
Yeah, that's really good. We will search that and put it in the show notes or figure out a way to get that to people.
Fantastic. It's literally just Google Jonathan Haidt.
We will.
Passionate companionate marriage, and the right images should come up, and you'll just be like, oh my gosh, especially if you're married, you'll be like, that is so true.
Yeah.
That's great. I love that.
And the other, I think, big challenge that comes to my mind is just soul ties and deep sexual deformation through kind of what the New Testament would call sexual immorality, what our culture would just call the progressive view of sex. And what it's doing to couples, you know, everything from pornography to adultery, which is a little bit easier to see how those are wreaking havoc in marriages, but even in couples sleeping together before marriage, which is becoming the new norm, even inside the church. And I think they often don't realize, even if literally they are virgins when they get engaged and they just sleep together in engagement before marriage and they've never slept with another person, I don't think people realize what that actually does, the way that that breaks trust that becomes incredibly important later in a marriage. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I think it's wreaking havoc in marriages. It's wreaking havoc. You know, the real tragedy is that it disproportionately benefits both divorce culture and the progressive sex ethic. Ironically, you would never hear this in the news, but it disproportionately affects, benefits men over women. Mm. And by benefits, I don't mean that by Christian metrics of benefit, but by secular metrics. So you won't hear this in the news, but if you sit down with it, again, evolutionary psychologists, which I just like to hear them kind of articulate.
Yeah, interesting.
Reasoning for some Judeo-Christian morality.
Yeah.
What if you were with, you know, Jordan Peterson or pick your famous evolutionary psychologist of choice, what they would say, and again, I cringe hearing this, much less saying this, but there's so much scientific and sociological data behind this that to refute it is just kind of foolish. Yeah. Basically, they would say that generally, men are primarily attracted based on physics and sexuality to women. And women are, again, this is not all women, just as a general rule, but there's so much evidence. It's like very safe to say, as a general rule, women are more attracted to status. Now, status can look like money. It can look like six-pack abs and killer triceps.
Interesting.
It can look like rock star fame. It can look like he's the best rock climber in the gym. It can look like anything.
Yeah.
They would also point out that sociologically, if you look at socioeconomics, men will regularly marry down the socioeconomic ladder and women almost never will.
Very interesting.
That's crazy.
It's just data. I'm not moralizing any of this.
Right.
It just is. You know, which is why it'll often a wealthy whatever, you know, went to Harvard will often marry somebody that was a stewardess on his, you know, United flight or whatever, but you'll rarely see the opposite. And almost never. And if you follow that logic through, men gain status as a general rule with time. So most 40-year-old men have more status than 20-year-old men.
Mm-hmm.
And youthful sexual appeal, no matter how beautiful a woman is, generally decreases with age and especially with childbearing.
That's so interesting.
You look at this sexually, if a man can get sex without marriage and or just look at remarriage, it's much easier for a divorced 45-year-old man or let's say 50-year-old man to remarry than it is for a woman, just statistically.
So
widespread divorce culture, which is pitched as women's liberation and you're free to be you and don't live under the oppression of commitment or whatever, it actually disproportionately allows men to be perpetual adolescents, have sex with whoever they want, not grow up, and if they don't like their wife anymore, divorce her and get somebody that they find more sexually attractive. And it is a tragedy for our society, for women in particular in our society, and for the church. So all that to say, I think the two greatest threats to marriage inside and outside of the church right now are idealization around a passionate view of marriage rather than a companionate view, and sexual immorality and soul ties with people that end up wreaking havoc in marriage long term and doing injustice toward women in particular.
Mind is blown.
No, don't be offended.
It is so good.
That's amazing, and I'm really glad you followed up and finished up with that because it's just.
I wish we could keep on talking, John Mark, but I know we are out of time.
Well, it's been amazing.
Let's have coffee soon.
Where can people find you, John Mark? Just real quick, you know.
My name is John Mark Comer, C-O-M-E-R. I have a website and I'm on Instagram and Twitter and that stuff. Just my name. Pretty easy to find.
And your podcast is?
Yes, I teach regularly at our church, which is Bridgetown Church. We have a podcast there where I teach on practices for the way of Jesus as well as from the Bible. And then I do a little podcast called This Cultural Moment with my buddy Mark Sayers, who's an Aussie, where we kind of deconstruct secular post-Christian culture for followers of Jesus in the West.
Awesome.
John Mark, it has been a pleasure. Let's do this soon again.
Sounds fun. I would love that, you guys. Keep doing what you're doing. I'm so grateful. In a world where marriage is just, you know, divorces through the roof, and the gift that you guys are to the church at large and the country and the world at large, man, and how you're using your story and honesty and hopefulness and resources to build. I can't think of really a better thing to give your life to. So,
yeah, well, amen. Well, and thank you for that.
Yeah, may the book do a lot of good in the world.
Yeah,
thank you so much.
Our prayer.
That means a lot. Yes.
Well, it's been a pleasure, John Mark. Look forward to talking again soon.
All right, talk soon.
You got it. Much love, you guys.
Bye.
Yeah, see ya.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Wow. What a conversation with John Mark. So you probably
have to rewind a little bit on that one.
Yes. Yeah. Back 15 seconds a bunch for that. We listened to it a couple times ourselves. He's just got a lot of great things to say. So good talking with him. Go give him a follow. Grab one of his books. Babe, what's going on this week?
Couple announcements for you guys this week. The first is, in case you guys did not see, we released the Love More sweatshirt that you guys have been asking for a while. And just to give you guys a backstory on these sweatshirts, we were not originally planning on selling these sweatshirts, but they were actually gifts that we sent out to a bunch of our friends and mentors and people who have inspired us along the journey of writing our book, A Love Letter Life. And then people started seeing them and asking about them and how they could get them. So we decided, well, let's just make them available for everybody else.
Yep. So these are inspired by the book.
They are due to
thousands of requests and popular demand. We're like, you know what? These would make a really good message.
Yeah. So it's kind of a way to continue the message that we are trying to get across in the book in a way. And the font that is the Love More on the front of the sweatshirt is actually the same typewriter font that's in the book too. So basically the idea is just, you know, there's always more ways that you can creatively, intentionally, and faithfully love your spouse or be crafting your own love letter life. And so
for me, it's
an encouragement to you guys as you rock your sweatshirts.
And for me, it's just culture at large. Like, as believers and Christians, like, we're supposed to be marked by loving. And I think if we get back to the real, you know, definition of that, not just our life, but everything would look a lot healthier. And so, yeah, it's just a message that we believe in. And so now they're available. If you want to grab one, you just go to alwaysmore.com and find it on the homepage there. So,
and they're on sale right now for launch. Not sure exactly how long they're going to be on sale for, but they are on sale right now. So if you want to grab one, and limited stock on them. So run if you want one before they go.
Yeah.
And if you guys are still one of the few people who have not grabbed your copy of A Love Letter Life yet,
we encourage you to do so.
You can download the Audible version of the book, which Jeremy and I recorded. So it's our actual voices reading the story to you. Or you can go grab a physical copy of the book anywhere books are sold. Amazon, I think, is still selling it for $12.20 right now on a massive sale, 55% off.
Last I checked.
So if you want to grab one there, you can do that as well. And last thing, we just always want to remind you guys, every episode we buy 5 of you coffee. All you have to do to be entered to get coffee on us is screenshot this week's episode or today's episode and share it to your Instagram stories and tag us. And we pick 5 of you to buy coffee every single episode.
So that means Tuesdays and Thursdays, we buy 5 of you coffee. As Audrey said, you just got to share a screenshot to your stories, tag at Jeremy Roloff, at Audrey Roloff, at Behind the Scenes Podcast, and you're entered to win.
That's all.
It's a lot of information. It's so good being back with Ember.
Yes.
Like, for good, you know, because we were coming back on tour, but you guys, she's just such a bundle of joy. Yeah. But she's definitely getting to that point where it's like, okay.
She's definitely in mama mode now that we're back.
Well, she's in mama mode, but she's starting to
realize what she's been missing out on the past few weeks.
Yeah, but I'm more saying, like, you know, she's almost 2.
Yeah.
And we can tell she's starting to want her things her way. So we're going to have lots of fun conversations about that in the future. All right, you guys, we appreciate you. Thank you. And we will talk to you next week.
Thursday. We'll see you Thursday.
We'll see you Thursday. Always a pleasure. All right. Until next time. Bye, guys.